going to open up the House Special Committee on Budgets Subcommittee on General Government, Transportation, and Economic Development. This morning is Thursday, June 30th, 2005. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 5126 relating to Bureau of Labor and Industries. Mr. Rocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you may recall back in May, on May 19th, you had this budget before you. You had a work session. Representative Avakian moved everything in the packet that you have in front of you. The only action the committee didn't take at that time was to move it to the full committee due pass. The packet you have before you has no changes in any numbers from what you approved earlier. The only change is on page 2 of the document I just gave you, which is a new budget note that's been approved by both the chair of the House Budget Committee and the Senate Budget Committee, talking about a prevailing wage rate advisory committee evaluating possibilities for streamlining procedures and reducing administrative costs for small public works projects.
Okay. So what we're going to need is a motion to approve the new budget note.
Yes, Mr. Chair. A motion to approve the new budget note and then a motion to amend the bill with the items on page 3 under number 4, and this is how the bill would be amended with those numbers, and then move the bill as amended to full due pass.
Any discussion?
No, Mr. Chair, I would move that we approve the budget note and that we amend the bill as described by Mr. Rocco and move it to the full committee with due pass recommendations.
Thank you. Representative Avakian moves to approve the new budget note as written and moves House Bill 5126 with the dash 2 amendments to the full House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none. So moved. I want to thank the Bureau of Labor and Industries for the work that they do, and we appreciate the time before our committee. Thank you very much. And we look forward to having you out in District 57 helping to support small business. Thank you. Thank you. We're okay, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 5126, and we are going to open up a work session on House Bill 2180 relating to elevators.
Mr. Chair, this House Bill 2180 eliminates annual elevator inspection requirements and allows the frequency and standards for inspections to be determined by administrative rule. The bill also separates elevator permit process and fees from the inspection schedule. It has an emergency clause and has an operative date of January 1st, 06. You heard this bill, I believe, yesterday, the day before. Sometimes.
Every day's the same now.
There's somebody who's been working way too long. Yeah.
I know it was in here recently. And there, the bill's non-fiscal, and there are no amendments.
Terrific. Really quick, Mr. Long, you want to come on up, and any thoughts or comments you want to share with us on House Bill 2180?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator, Building Codes. I think staff did a good job of the overview. This is a bill that's going to allow us to streamline our elevator inspections. And as I indicated, I think it was on Tuesday, although my memory might not be as well. It's good. The statute right now says that we regulate elevators that move 12 inches or 12 stories the same. And this allows us to prioritize our inspections, work with the building owners and managers and the industry and our boards to figure out what's the right inspection frequency and allow us to focus on life safety issues as opposed to just inspect because the statute says that we inspect.
Appreciate your leadership in bringing this efficiency bill forward. These are the type of bills that result in good government. I appreciate that.
Move House Bill 2182. Oh, you got it. Are we in work session still?
We are in work session. Any further comments?
Chair, I have to carry the bill on the floor.
All righty.
I'll move House Bill 2180 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Vaki moves House Bill 2180 to the House Special Committee on Budget with the due pass recommendation.
I'm fine, Mr. Chair. My only concern with this bill is it may or may not make our elevators in this building work better.
See no other comments. House Bill 2180 is passed. Representative Bucking, would you carry that one? Okay. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 2180. We're going to jump over House Bill 2181 temporarily, and we are going to go into open a work session on House Bill 2527 relating to manufactured structures. Good morning.
Good morning. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you have not had this in front of you.
Oh, we have.
Mr. Chair and subcommittee members, the bill, as it was received by the budget committee, came to you as a creation of a new agency. It came out of the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. It was a fairly substantial bill, and what I received yesterday afternoon was a -3 amendment, which I've also distributed to you, and I understand that there may be some additional
correct
language in front of you. Okay. Which the original -3 amendment eliminated the content of the bill and substituted additional membership on the Manufactured Structures and Parks Advisory Board and expanding the range of statutes on which the board would provide advice to the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And it increased the statutory reference to the minimum number of advisory board meetings each year from 1 to 3. The conceptual amendment, as I understand it, deletes the expansion of the statutory discussions by the advisory board with the director. It eliminates the 2 additional positions and substitutes twice each year for every 3 months for board meeting schedule.
What I'm going to do at this time is see if Ms. Streisinger would come up, Mr. Miner would come up, and is Mr. Long here as well?
Yes.
The 3 of you could come on up. I think we're going to need one more chair. If each of you just very quickly could introduce yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes Division.
And I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association.
Thank you. I understand the 3 of you have gotten together and have communicated on this issue, and as a compromise, in return for eliminating certain sections of this bill, that your department has agreed to something. Can you share with us what that is?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Again, Corey Streisinger. We have no objection to the conceptual amendment as identified by LFO staff that deletes those portions of the -3 and has the board meeting twice a year. In addition to that, on the issues that surround last session's Senate Bill 468, Mr. Long and I had already discussed putting together an advisory committee to assist us with the next phase of that program, and I will commit to you and I will commit to Mr. Miner and I will send him a letter committing to putting that advisory group together. We should have it in place by August 1st, and we expect that it will meet regularly.
Thank you. And then one other issue that I understand was discussed is in the -3s, it was asked that the board shall meet at least every 3 months. And in the conceptual amendments, it's down to twice each year. and I understand that there was an additional agreement on this.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The additional agreement is that we would contact the chair of the board and see if there's additional meetings above the statutory minimums that I think that the amendment would put forward at two times a year.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well.
Thank you. Is this something all three of you can live and agree with?
I think so.
I feel like King Solomon here.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify. Were you talking with respect to administrative rule changes later to accommodate that, or recommendations for statutory changes?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, with respect to the advisory committee, we would do that on an informal basis the same way we put together advisory committees on a regular basis. So we would not put it in rule. We do not think it needs to be in statute, but we will do it, and we are committing to you, and we are committing to Mr. Minor that we will do it.
So then I'm going to turn to Adrian on this. Just so I'm very clear, my understanding is that we'd be striking out the bolded language on the dash three amendments on line 13, 14, and 15. We'd be striking out on page 2, line 8, 9.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Line 16?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Restore 12.
Restore that. To keep that at 12.
Okay. Is there?
Sorry. Oh, thank you. You want to change that? What am I missing on line 8?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that while that language has been added, it simply is making the reference back to the board that is currently established and saying that the board shall serve in an advisory capacity. It's just breaking up the sentence.
But okay. And then on page 2, line 8, line 9, line 10, and line 11 would be deleted. On line 18, where it says every 3 months, that would be struck, and it would say the board shall meet at least twice each year.
So the word once would also be struck
as well. And then on line 19, I assume it returned back to 7 members shall constitute a quorum, and 8 would be struck.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Don, is that?
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, may I offer one additional comment?
Please.
I had a conversation in the hall with a representative of one of the other stakeholders involved, and I would just say for the record that we would appreciate hearing from any stakeholders interested in this issue concerning the advisory committee. If they have suggestions for membership, we'd certainly like to hear from them.
And I want to thank all three of you for working through this issue. All three of you are passionate in working for the betterment of Oregon, and I think this is a fair compromise that will and can work for everyone. So, Representative Abaki.
I would move that the committee accept the conceptual amendments to House Bill 2527. And that with those amendments, we move the bill to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Avakian moves House Bill 2527 with the proposed amendments to the full committee, the full House Committee on Budget. Still trying to get the House Special Committee on Budget. Any discussion? Seeing none, so moved. Thank you very much. Best of luck to all of you. All right, we're going to close now the work session on House Bill 2527. Adrian, thank you very much on that. And we are now going to open up a work session on House Bill 2461 relating to notary publics. Monica. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2461 relating to notary publics was heard yesterday, and I believe you also had a discussion of the Dash A2 amendments, which are before you, make some minor adjustments. The bill requires that new commission notary public, it requires a 3-hour education. Currently, Corporation Division is offering these On a voluntary basis, this makes it mandatory for all new commissions beginning July 1, 2006. The Dash A2 specifies that Secretary of State can authorize employers of notaries public to offer the training, and specifies that if a notary is currently employed, that their training can be industry-specific or employment-specific. This has no fiscal impact, as the work is already being done by the Corporations Division.
Help me here. I'm still unclear on this. If the notary public is employed, the employer, who's going to provide the industry-specific training?
Mr. Chair, my understanding, and I don't know if there is anyone in the proponents in the room on this, my understanding is that the bill allows the Secretary of State to have employers offer training. If employers meet the criteria that will be established by the Secretary of State in rule, then those employers would be permitted to train their employees in, for example, real estate-specific work or... I don't know, I'm at a loss at whether land use, banking, any specific training to those particular individuals.
Do we have any folks out there that are supporting these amendments? The concern I have, and it's not concern, the question I have is who's going to provide the training, at what cost, and who has? How do we know they have the expertise to provide that specialized training? And so what I'm going to actually do on this one, since we don't have the folks here to advocate on behalf of House Bill 2461, is I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2461 until I get an answer to that.
Great.
Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay. Fine. All right. Now, we're going to move into House Bill. We're going to close the work session. We are now going to open a public hearing. Yes. Yes.
Mayor,
please. There was a compromise reached.
Yes.
And,
I understand that.
Okay.
And I'm an aye.
And I. So Representative Crump is an aye on House Bill 2527. And we are now going to. Which one do you want us to go to here, Dallas? Do you want us to go? Either one?
Either one is fine with me.
All right. what's your preference?
2608 would be my preference.
We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2608. Dallas.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2608 would require that prior to either renewing or replacing a driver's license, the applicant provide proof of legal residence and federal ID number. The bill has fiscal and SMS before you. And
thank you, Dallas. Chair would like to call Jim Ludwig for it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Ludwig, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak in favor of House Bill 2608 today. Currently, Oregon is one of only six states that doesn't check the Social Security number of driver's license applicants. And obviously, a driver's license is far more than just a certificate that says you can legally drive in the state of Oregon. It's our primary source of identification. We use it to cash checks, to board planes, to register to vote. In fact, when the 19 Islamic terrorists, came in the United States, one of the first orders of business they had was to secure a driver's license. As you're probably aware, a number of them were here on six-month visas. Once they got their driver's license, which was good for 6 to 8 years, they no longer needed their visa. In fact, they used their driver's license to open bank accounts, move around the United States, and board planes on 9/11. Raymond Martinez is the director of the New York Department of Transportation. Martinez, by administrative rule, put New York Department of Transportation into the online Social Security verification system. Martinez said, and I quote, "After 9/11, we no longer had a choice but to change our driver's license requirements. We owe it to the victims of the terrorist attack and our citizens to ensure that our driver's license are not used as a tool to commit another attack on us, unquote. When the New York Department of Transportation sent the Social Security numbers of the driver's license applicants for verification to the Social Security Administration, they came back with over 500,000 mismatched numbers. They then sent out 500,000 notices informing people that they would lose their driver's license if they didn't rectify the problem. They eventually narrowed it down to 250,000, and New York is in the process of revoking the driver's licenses of 250,000 individuals. Martinez said that at one point they had over 500 New York City taxicab drivers who had at least three valid New York driver's licenses. One had 16. The reason for the multiple licenses is if somebody got a DUI, too many accidents or too many tickets, they could keep a clean record on one and still continue to drive their cab in New York City. And unfortunately, having multiple licenses isn't unique to New York. In Oregon, there's been numerous instances where criminals have had more than one and sometimes three or four Oregon driver's licenses when they've committed crimes. It's impossible to talk about House Bill 2608 without referring to the Real ID Act. The Real ID Act was signed into law on May 11th of this year. Among the provisions in that bill are that states have to meet certain requirements for the issuance of driver's licenses. They require a state to verify that the citizen or the person applying for a driver's license is either a citizen or legally in the country. They require that the person submit a Social Security number, which is then sent to the Social Security Administration for verification. They no longer accept any form of a foreign ID other than a passport. And for all non-citizens, their driver's license expires on the date their legal status in this country expires. All those provisions are in House Bill 2608. Let me quickly review the online Social Security verification system. There are two main components to it. One is the batch system. The other is the online system. The batch system is where states send all existing driver's license Social Security numbers back to the Social Security Administration for verification. It costs a quarter of a penny a transaction. As an example, it cost Idaho $1,400 to do retroactively look at all their existing driver's licenses. The online system is the system that states use to send all new driver's license applicants to the Social Security Administration for verification. That takes place while the person's at the counter. It takes 25 to 30 seconds to verify, and it costs the state 3 cents a transaction. If Oregon does this plan, and they had, say, 30,000 in a year, it would cost the state about $900. Oregon has 3 years to comply with the Real ID Act. If it doesn't do that, our driver's license will be no longer good to board planes, to enter federal buildings, or apply for jobs. In essence, the Oregon's driver's license will be good as a form only of proof of driving within the state of Oregon. Some people might say, well, you got 3 years, why the rush? Why do we need House Bill 2608 this session? We need House Bill 2608 this session to enable the Oregon Department of Transportation the lead time necessary to implement all the laws of the Real ID Act. In addition, Oregonians are going to see a continued erosion of the value of our driver's license outside the state of Oregon if we don't make changes. Even now, Nevada refuses to accept the Oregon driver's license as proof of ID for someone moving from Oregon to Nevada. When the Oregon legislature opened up in January of this year, there were 11 states that did not verify the Social Security numbers of driver's license applicants. In the short time this session has been going on, 5 more states have entered that process. 2 more are in process of doing that. In a short while, Oregon will be one of only 4 states that does not verify the Social Security numbers of driver's license applicants.
And Jim, if I may interrupt you, that's what this visual is here.
This map, clearly shows that.
The red states are the states that are not participating in the Social Security system in terms of verification, correct?
That's correct. And you can see Oregon sticks out like a sore thumb.
Okay. Excuse me a moment.
We're under a call?
Okay. We are going to recess the committee for a moment, and we will resume discussions on this bill and others when we return from the floor. So stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen.
Ending is that Mr. Ludwig was testifying before us. Was there any additional comments you wanted to share with us?
Close, if I might.
Please.
I showed the map here, and what the map illustrates is in red the states that don't verify the Social Security numbers of driver's license applicants. The green is states who are in the process of entering that program, and the blue is all everybody else. Oregon is going to be one of only four states that doesn't verify the Social Security numbers of driver's license applicants. And the problem that that's going to create, if you look on the West Coast from west of Mississippi, we're the only state that doesn't do that. Oregon will become more of a magnet for ID theft, the methamphetamine trade, and illegal immigration if we don't adopt House Bill 2608. So I urge you to do that.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I'm going to call up Anthony Ho. Please, come on up. You just introduce yourself for the record when you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, and other interested parties, my name is Anthony Ho. I'm a supervisory special agent with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement within the Department of Homeland Security. Out of Portland, Oregon. First, let me note that I do not take a position on the proposed legislation because I'm a member of the federal government. I'm simply here to present to you facts and experiences that are directly relevant to the HB 2608 so you can make an informed decision.
Yeah, you're here on behalf of the federal government, not as an individual. Is that correct?
That's correct. My appearance has been cleared through the special agent in charge out of Seattle, which is the SAC office controlled in Portland, Oregon. Anyway, I've worked for 18 years for immigration and now for Homeland Security as a special agent, as a supervisor, and as a manager. I've directly supervised agents involved in Joint Terrorism Task Force, the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, and other bodies. I've also served on the Oregon High-Intensity Drug Trafficking Board, the Oregon HIDA, and other managerial bodies for law enforcement groups. So I'm very familiar with the areas of document fraud, alien smuggling, hiring of foreign workers, worker exploitation, and also alien crimes. And I just want to bring to your attention that the standards in Oregon for obtaining a driver's license or an identification card have resulted in a number of problems that I just want to bring to your attention. The first problem is the problem of alien smuggling. The generous rules in Oregon are such that they act as a magnet, bringing people into Oregon solely for the purpose of obtaining an Oregon driver's license or an Oregon identification card. And the evidence we have suggests that literally tens of thousands of people have been smuggled into Oregon solely for the purpose of obtaining a legitimate Oregon identification or driver's license, which could later be exchanged in another state through reciprocity for a driver's license, and thus circumventing laws in other states designed to prevent people from getting driver's license that the state has decided they're not entitled to them. I'll give you a couple.
Representative Buckin.
Yes, I'm sorry.
You, with as much specificity as is possible, given your role with the government, talk about how you get to that conclusion, meaning where does the information come from that allows you to come to the conclusion that we have that many people being smuggled into Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, thank you very much. I will endeavor to give you very specific information. In late 2003 and 2004, we uncovered a scheme involving the smuggling of people into Oregon to do driver's license testing. And during that investigation, we discovered that third-party testers had been involved in smuggling people into Oregon and engaging in testing to get them Oregon driver's licenses when, in fact, they were not Oregon residences. And a review of the records indicates that this one testing, just one company, had provided tests to over 23,000 individuals. And third-party testers around the state had done over 40,000 tests of that sort. So we have reason to believe that literally tens of thousands of people had done that. In 2001, we had reports from DMVs all over the state that people were coming in by the van load from out of state in vans with out of state plates to obtain Oregon driver's licenses. So that's where we get the numbers from, sir.
And so that, Mr. Chairman, it's okay. And so that comes from a personal, first-hand testimony of DMV workers. The part about when you said information from DMV about vans coming in.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Akin, yes, that comes from the information just provided, comes from our investigations, comes from the DMV, comes from arrests that we've made all over the state of van loads of people showing up at DMV from out of state solely for the purpose of getting Oregon identification.
And forgive me for not being more familiar with it, but is this all information that is part of the public record somewhere, or accessible by the public, or is it part of an investigation and therefore confidential?
Some of it, Representative Vaki and Mr. Chair, some of it is available on the Internet. Some of the cases are still pending, so specific details are not releasable, but a simple search of news reports related to alien smuggling in Oregon will uncover the cases that I've talked about.
I need to ask a point of clarification.
Sure.
And I apologize for being naive on this. When you say smuggling people into Oregon,
mm-hmm.
What should I be visualizing?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I guess the visualization I want is simply people that are not, they're foreign nationals, they don't live in Oregon, they are being brought into Oregon by van, by car, they're simply traveling through the interstates to come into Oregon simply for the purpose of getting an Oregon driver's license.
Is somebody marketing a service where if you pay someone a fee, they will work with you to bring you up to Oregon to get you the license?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. For example, in the case that I referred to, that it was late 2003, early 2004, that particular individual actually had radio commercials in California encouraging people to come to Oregon because the laws to get a license in Oregon were so lax that it would be easy to get a license in Oregon. So literally there were radio commercials to encourage people to come to Oregon to get a license.
Wow. Thank you.
So let me continue. That was just on the issue of alien smuggling. Another issue is the methamphetamine trade. Now, I don't want to suggest that all illegal aliens are involved in the methamphetamine trade. That would be absurd. But what I do want to make clear is that when we've the methamphetamine trade, number one, is predominantly conducted by illegal aliens in this state. And when we arrest the illegal aliens involved in the methamphetamine trade, they have Oregon identification and they have Oregon driver's licenses. So what I'm suggesting is that if, as a tool, removing that tool of having an Oregon driver's license or an Oregon identification card would be useful in combating the methamphetamine trade, particularly since methamphetamine is moved along freeways and highways. I believe the issue of false identity and national security has already been covered by a previous speaker, but just to give you an example, although this is in another state, Virginia, in that state, they did not have a foreign residency verification requirement, but what happened was they hired an illegal alien to actually testify that they were, as to their address, and they were thereafter able to obtain Virginia driver's licenses, and then those hijackers were thereafter able themselves to use their driver's licenses and their identities to verify two other hijackers as well. So, again, there's national security issues tied into that. And not only that, verification is important because if I were to walk into a DMV and claim to be Britney Spears, if the DMV were to actually issue me...
I see the resemblance.
Yeah, you know, I am often mistaken for her, that and Tom
me
Cruise.
Too.
Yeah. Actually, a little like Ed Harris, maybe, but... only a younger version. At any rate,
you're not inspiring a great deal of confidence in our homeland security.
It's great for working undercover in the rock trade. At any rate, the point is that DMV documents are breeder documents, and if I were to have my identity legitimated by a DMV, I would be able to go out and use it to get other forms of identification. So I don't think any much more needs to be said about that. Let's see. Finally, exploitation. In my experiences, I've seen that smugglers and people that exploit illegal aliens from time to time will actually hold on to identity documents as a means of controlling people that they are in the process of exploiting. So, for example, we've had cases around the country where, on the sex trade, they will smuggle women and hold on to their passports. Or in California, they will. They were holding on to the social security cards of the people that they were exploiting as a means of controlling them, because the people were unfamiliar with the system, and that's how they were controlling them. So, likewise, if we can ensure that driver's licenses and identification cards are only issued to people legally in the U.S. or U.S. citizens, it really, in some sense, removes a tool for people to be exploited. I'm not suggesting that alone is the only way to stop exploitation, but it does. If people can't get a driver's license, then obviously that just removes a tool for an exploiter. So anyway, I just want to say I hope the information I provided today will help the committee in making its deliberations, and that whatever comes out, that it will address the concerns I've raised, which is illegal immigration, alien smuggling, the drug trade, national security, and worker exploitation. So thank you again for this opportunity. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Besides the obvious that the issues you brought up will continue to proceed, what happens if we continue to wait for a couple of years, if we don't pass this bill?
Well, I think, again, this is a very difficult to be a prognosticator. I can't say. As was mentioned before, the Real ID Act is something that needs to be dealt with, and I think, obviously, it's better to deal with a problem sooner rather than later. And frankly, I think when it comes to illegal immigration, all that takes for that to succeed is for good men and women to sit back and do nothing. And I think, what we have is a situation where, obviously, from what I've described, it's a very chaotic situation. And I think it's important that we bring the rule of law and bring some order to the process.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yes, Representative Bakken.
I don't think there would be very little dispute that with respect to people coming in that are going to do illegal, bad things in this country, drug trade, terrorism, all the things you've alluded to, that we don't want those people getting IDs and having accessibility to airplanes and buses and whatever else, I don't know. But we've also got thousands and thousands of people that work on the ranches and the farms of Oregon and in other states that some of them that even drive as a part of their jobs, some of them that have been here for generation after generation. Now, I'm not arguing that those people should be here undocumented. But what I'm wondering about is what the federal government's intent is with regard to driving privileges for those types of individuals, as opposed to the law enforcement type of getting the bad guys that you've described.
Well, sir, Mr. Chair and Representative Vakian, I'm not a policymaker, so I cannot address specifically what the federal government's policy is or will be on granting driver's licenses to those people. But if somebody's been here for generations and generations, they're a U.S. citizen, so obviously they would be entitled to a driver's license or identity card. And likewise, I think there are processes in place in immigration to immigrate people legally as workers and so forth. And obviously the idea is to encourage people to obey the law, to use legal immigration processes to get their workers. And if those people are here legally, then there's no problem in terms of them getting an identification card or driver's licenses. So I would always encourage the rule of law and order to the process.
Well, let me ask you a different way then. because from the state level, I'm not sure what the federal government's view on what our obligations should be. We have DMV offices, and say there's somebody who's lived here for 15 years and has worked, and they are not here legally, and they go in to renew their driver's license, and they can't provide the proper documentation. Two questions, I guess. One, what do you expect our state government to do with that individual? And then, two, what's the federal government's response to that individual?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vakian, in terms, I can only address this from an enforcement perspective, and I cannot address it from any other perspective, honestly. The fact is that Oregon has laws already in effect that prevent the disclosure of information from state entities to federal immigration authorities for enforcement purposes, except in very limited circumstances. So obviously, you know, what I expect the state to do is to continue to follow the existing laws that it currently has in place that prevent that disclosure of information. What will the federal government do? Well, obviously, independent of that, if we develop information, we expect to continue our current enforcement practices. And, you know, I can't begin to guess as to whether Oregon law will change or if the federal practice will change, but I can tell you what's going on right now.
Let's do this. We're under a call to the House. When we come back, I think it's going to be our privilege to have Representative Groon hopefully come back, and we'll start up with his testimony.
Thank you. So,
thank you. We're going to recess. I may be. I'm not sure. We'll find out when we get. And go back into our public hearing on House Bill 2608. We're going to call next Mr. Jim Elvin. Welcome. If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Jim Elvin. I reside here in Salem. I'm not going to take up a lot of your time. I just wanted to let you know that I'm here in favor of this bill. I think it's very necessary for Oregon to pass this bill. But I'm submitting testimony from Elizabeth Van Staveren, and I'd like to leave that for you.
Perfect.
And I won't take any more of your time. I don't understand how this could be a negotiable thing with the evidence that's been brought forth. I think Oregon needs this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your patience in coming to the Capitol during this time when we're running back and forth. It's kind of the nature of this game, though, as we're getting towards the end. So thank you. All righty. It is my distinct pleasure to bring up Representative Broom to testify before us. This is, my understanding, this is his bill.
There you go.
And we're honored to have this before us today, and we're honored to have you before us. So welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. You must have a shortcut way to get to the House floor to here and back. I haven't learned that one.
I've heard the trick.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Bruin. I'm the State Representative from House District 37, and I appreciate you hearing this bill. I know that people that have preceded me have given you a great outline of what this bill does and the various benefits of this bill. Let me just say that, give me a real quick history of how this came to me. This came to me as so much legislation does. A person came in my office and said, you ought to think about this. You ought to be aware of this. In this particular case, it was a Portland police officer that I've known for about 10 years. I have a lot of respect for, a great guy. And he came to my office back in January, probably, maybe early February, and said, this ought to be a law. And he outlined, he said basically that to get a driver's license in the state of Oregon, you ought to be a resident of Oregon, and beyond that, either a legal U.S. citizen or here legally. And I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's got to be current law. And he informed me that it wasn't. We went and did some research, and true to fact, it's not current law. I've talked to a lot of people about this. I've talked to the press about this. Lots and lots of folks. Lots and lots of folks have various opinions on this, both pro and con. My point about this is that if this were 5 years ago, I would feel much less strongly about it than I do now. 4 years ago, I'd feel much less strongly about it. But we live in a different world now, and I don't want to continue to beat a dead horse. I know that's been mentioned, but we live in a significantly different world than we did 4 years ago. And we, unlike most countries in the world, do not have a national ID card. There's reasons we don't have a national ID card. Some I agree with, some I don't. But the fact of the matter is, the United States does not have a national ID card, and it doesn't look like the political pressure will allow us to have a national ID card anytime soon. So basically, the next best thing, if you will, is the state driver's license. And the state driver's license in all 50 states has become, in effect, the keys to the kingdom. It is your national ID card, even though it says California or Oregon or Washington or Idaho or whatever it says on the card, that is your national ID card. It is critical that not only that law enforcement in the state of Oregon, not only in the state of Oregon, but across the nation as well as federal law enforcement, have the faith that the Oregon driver's license or the Oregon ID card is what it says, that they have the faith that it's worth the plastic it's printed on. And without being pejorative about it, they don't have that faith right now with the Oregon driver's license. It's easy to get. We have evidence, anecdotal evidence at the least, that shows that Oregon's almost become a hub for illegal activity in driver's licenses. It's easy to get a driver's license in Oregon. And once again, maybe 5 years ago, that's a credit to Oregon. But in this world, I think it's a discredit to Oregon. I think it's our responsibility as public servants to change that. I've said to a lot of groups that I believe that the number one responsibility of government at any level, state level, local level, federal level, is public safety. And any failure to adequately provide sufficient levels of public safety is a fundamental failure of government. If we do not act on this with all the evidence that we have that supports us, from the 9/11 Commission to all the anecdotal evidence from police and criminal justice agencies, if we don't act this, I believe that we are being irresponsible in our duties as public servants. One last thing. I know this bill, I tend to talk about it in terms of this is the national security thing to do. This is the thing to do that when we have evidence from the 9/11 Commission, these are things we need to do. You know, there's a lot of people that talk about this bill in regard to its effect on the migrant culture, both legal immigrant and illegal immigrant culture. And I have to tell you, when this came to me, that was a concern I had as well. I certainly don't feel that I am and don't want to be construed as anti-immigrant. And so one of the very first things I did before we had it drafted as a bill, I went to my chief of staff, my legislative assistant, who happens to be a legal immigrant. She's from Brazil. And I said, look at this. I go, what do you think about this? And so she spent some time looking at it. She looked at our statute, and basically she came back to me and she said she absolutely supports it. And the reason she absolutely supports it is because truth of the matter is, she's gone through every hurdle there is. I mean, she's had to deal with the State Department. She's had to deal with INS. She's had to deal with agency after agency after bureaucracy after bureaucracy after bureaucracy. And it's hard. It is difficult. It is absolutely difficult. But she's done it. She's done it legally. She's done it correctly. She's absolutely legal to be here. And she's proud. She wants to be in the United States. And she's absolutely proud to be here and proud of the effort that she's put in, because she wants the benefits that being a legal immigrant and eventually a U.S. citizen of the United States entail. And so in her mind, when people come in, immigrants come in and don't do that and circumvent the system, she is absolutely, I mean, mad is not the right word. So in my mind, it passed the smell test. I went to her as a legal immigrant. I said, does this pass your test? And she said, absolutely. So with that, Mr. Chair and committee, I would just highly encourage you to favorably vote this out of committee. I just gave a great speech, Brad, but you missed
one. Oh, sorry about that.
It answered all your questions.
Talk too fast.
It answered all your questions.
I expect when you get up, it's going to go on for 10 or 12 minutes. I can get most of the good parts.
Well, Representative Broom, we appreciate that testimony. I would really like to invite you to join us up at the dais, if that'll work with
your
schedule.
Until the next call, right?
You bet. So we'd love to have you come up here and join us, and please feel free to participate and ask any questions, because we appreciate your leadership on this issue. So,
want to move even closer?
Yeah, come on over. All righty. We are going to, why don't we bring up Ms. Young from DMV next, and we'll get into the technical details of this.
I asked her the question you asked, so she's ready.
Perfect. Okay. It's good seeing you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lorna Youngs, administrator of the DMV. And I've provided you with written testimony, but I'm not going to go over that in great detail because you've heard a lot of the information already. Primarily what I wanted to do is essentially walk you through what changes the DMV would be making should the bill pass. You've already heard that the requirements of House Bill 2608 are essentially echoing requirements that are in the Federal Real ID Act, but would put those requirements in place sooner than what the state would need to do to be in compliance by mid-2008. So what essentially we would be doing under the, if the bill were to pass, would be to connect with the Social Security Administration and verify. Currently, we are collecting Social Security numbers, but have not given authorization to verify those. So we would be verifying Social Security numbers. We have actually been gotten approval to seek a federal grant from Federal Motor Carrier that would allow us to connect with the Social Security Administration to get that system in place in Oregon. And then we would also be requiring proof of legal presence or citizenship in the U.S. Individuals who do not who have immigrant legal status in the U.S. but don't have Social Security numbers, we would be connecting with the Department of Homeland Security to what is known as their SAVE system, which is their systematic alien verification of entitlement system, and we would be verifying their alien registration number. So those are two bits of programming that we would need to do. And then in addition, we would also need to obviously place a note in the record once we had verified a person's immigration status or legal status, so that once, if you were permanently in the U.S., so you were a U.S. citizen or had permanent residence, we wouldn't be asking you to prove every time you renewed. Those individuals who had temporary status then, of course, would need to have their driver license expire on the date in which their temporary status expires. And then when they, if they were to get extended status, they would need to come in. We would again establish a new driver license expiration date for them based on their new status or their new date of expiration. And those are the primary changes that we'll be making in the system as a result of this bill. We put a fiscal impact on this of approximately $750,000. A quarter of that is for the would be for the connection with the Social Security Administration system. And we would, we're also looking at the fact that this does bear an additional FTE cost for us because of the additional time it will take to do the verifications, to ask for the additional documentation, to review it, to discuss the issue. What we, when we prepare our fiscal impacts, essentially we have a rather sophisticated system of doing timings of how long it takes to do a specific kind of activity, multiply it by the number of forecasted transactions of that particular type. And that's how we arrive at what we see as the fiscal impact on personnel. We've also, of course, subtracted the volume of transactions or the driver licenses that we anticipate we would no longer issue, and we are basing that on the 2000 census, which estimates about a 2.6 population of individuals in Oregon who do not have legal immigration status. That number may or may not be accurate.
Sure. Is that 2.6 number, is that of the entire population or is that of the immigrant population?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruhn, that is of the population of Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
We have no other established census or figures to base an estimate on, so we went to the census. It may very well be an underrepresentation of the number of individuals who would ultimately not end up with a driver license or identification card.
Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've already taken great steps in planning how you're going to have to accommodate the federal law, and I appreciate your testimony on kind of the nuts and bolts of how you're going to do this. But I'd like you to discuss something from a more, I guess, theoretical perspective with regard to the Department of Motor Vehicles and the role of the state in this issue, because I think it just seems odd to me that we have at both the national and the state level decided that it's going to be Department of Motor Vehicle offices that whose job is really to make sure that people know how to drive and that they're licensed to drive, that that privilege is managed, is now going to be the great arbiter of managing illegal immigration, at least in this way, and that the driver's license has all of a sudden become the item of identifying who's legal and who isn't legal. It just seems so odd. I mean, we don't do it with marriage licenses. We don't do it with professional licenses. We don't do it with high school identification cards. I mean, there's so many different ways people get identified in this world. How does it fit the mission of the Department of Motor Vehicles to become the arbiter of immigration issues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, I can only speculate that because driver license agencies for years, as a result of their need to make sure that the person present before them is the person who says who they are, because driver license agencies have developed processes to verify who you are, driver license agencies then became the agencies that also were given the responsibility of providing identification cards, state-issued identification cards. And every driver license agency that I know of does both the driver license and the identification card, because we have the processes in place. And once you put a photo on a card, which we started doing, 15 years ago, once you put a photo on a card, then it has a value much more than a piece of paper, which a marriage license or anything else. And so it emerged, I can only say, just as the Social Security number, which was simply meant to identify you for your benefits, now has emerged as the identifying number that ties together all of your financial transactions. That's something that emerged out of the existence of it. So for good or ill or policy decision, DMVs across the nation find themselves in the position of having to provide this additional service.
Let me interrupt you because we're going to have to go. Let me make one brief comment so folks can think before we get back in case we follow up on it.
Sure.
It just seems odd that we take something as absolutely critical as proper immigration rules, civil rights, and the defense of our entire country, and we choose as the one identifying criteria we're going to use as one that is limited by age and ability.
Mm-hmm.
And then completely ignores the rest of the population. Seems like an odd thing for us to do.
We're going to be in recess. I'm anticipating we should be back in about 5 to 8 minutes. Thank you. On House Bill 2608, and as we were leaving, Representative Avakian was...
Just leaving it hanging.
That was a fast 5 minutes.
Leaving the thought hanging. We'll just leave it there.
Okay.
Unless anybody wants to say something about it, and then...
Let me... I have a few questions on the handout. On page 2, under impacts to the department, it talks about on the second paragraph, DMV will need to review additional documents, including immigration documents, and collect a number issued by DHS if the person is not eligible for a Social Security number. How long do you anticipate that taking?
You mean how many seconds? We've got timings on the reviewing of documents. We're looking, I think, approximately 45 seconds, I think, is what we've looked for additional document analysis.
Walk me through that. This is a budget committee. We're not a policy committee. Mm-hmm. Walk me through how that works. I come in, and you need to verify my status. What do you ask me?
Representative Smith, you first, of course, will have to prove that you've got all your basic requirements in that you'll have documentation that proves your identity.
Okay, so I come in and I hand you my current driver's license.
And now, in addition to the current driver license, you will need to provide for us either a U.S. passport or a original birth certificate or any kind of certificate of being born abroad.
Social Security card?
That will be secondary. The Social Security card is not proof that you're a U.S. citizen, so you will need to now provide us with, and there'll be a list of documents that will be acceptable proofs of U.S. citizenship. So they would be a U.S. passport, which says on it you're a citizen, your birth certificate, your record of birth abroad, or immigration papers that show that you are a permanent resident or a naturalized citizen. And those would be the categories that would allow you to essentially say that you can continuously receive a driver license, and so you would.
Then I hand my driver's license and I hand the birth certificate. Then what?
Then we would review the documents to determine whether or not you're legally present. And then we would be asking you for your Social Security number.
In the form of a card or in form of a question?
You could either do it as a card or a question, because we'll be... The way we have the system set up now is that if you are presenting your Social Security card as one of the proofs of your identity, you need to physically give us the card and we examine it for authenticity. We're also required now to collect Social Security numbers for everyone in order to be in compliance with the Child Welfare Act, the Federal Child Welfare Act, but we don't verify those. So whether you give it to us as a card or whether you give us the number, we will then go into the online inquiry system that will, I believe it will be sending your Social Security number, your name, and date of birth. There are three or four things that go together. And we will receive back match or no match information about whether or not whether John Smith, date of birth XYZ, Social Security number is a match with what's on the Social Security system. So if you have proof of citizenship with you and your Social Security number matches up, then we will make a note in the record that you've established that you are a U.S. citizen, and we will issue you your driver license for the first time if it's the first one, or we will renew it, or we will provide the duplicate if whatever that transaction happens to be. And thereafter, you will not be required to provide proof of legal presence, because we will have it in the system that you are. If you are here under legal immigration...
That proof comes under the notes section.
Yes, that's where we'll put a notation in the record. There'll be a space that we'll have to create in the driving record where we'll have what your legal status is, whether you're a permanent resident or permanently here or not. If you are, however, here with a temporary status, say you're on a three-year visa or a student visa or some kind of visa, then we will look at your immigration documents to determine the expiration date. We will be asking for a Social Security number, and we'll verify that. If you're not eligible for a Social Security number, then we will then take the alien registration number, which is on the immigration document, and we'll be verifying that with Department of Homeland Security to verify that your immigration papers are correct. And then we will be issuing you a temporary driver license, which expiration date will correspond with the expiration date of your immigration documents.
The reason why I'm asking these questions, and I think Dallas came and shared with us earlier, mm-hmm. is I'm trying to figure out, because we are a budget committee, where the justification comes that we're going to need seven positions.
And that comes from our timings in relationship to the time it takes to examine the additional documents, to have first of all, to have conversations with people about what the requirements are. There'll be an additional amount of time it takes when there's a rejection. We have an explanation. What to the individual? What do they need to do to resolve problems if the matches don't come back? There will be a certain amount of time to review the responses from the SSA to enter the additional information into the record. If there are additional checks that need to be made, we've factored in that, because what we've done is checked with other states to see what percentage of time are there no matches that require another inquiry. How long do those take to resolve? So we essentially take 45 seconds for the initial document check, multiply that by 430 licenses, and that's how we arrive at the amount of minutes over the whole state that it would take to implement this, and then arrive at an FTE figure for this.
This body said this was important, and we passed on, the governor signed it into law, that there are inefficiencies found in DMV to where that additional $763,000 could just somehow be worked in through your processes?
What we're really looking at is, if you want to have no change in wait time. That's why we, in other words, yes, you could add more time to processes, and we could put no fiscal impact on it, and the result is a longer wait time. So whenever you change the driver license issuance process, you make it longer and more complex, require more information from individuals, it creates an impact in terms of more time it to do the same transaction.
But hold on a sec. It's 7 positions. Are we going to spread those throughout the state then?
We would take the positions and take a look at where the highest volume of transactions are and allocate those positions probably more heavily on the west side. We are always in the process of balancing the workload among our field offices. So, yes, they would be. Obviously, you're not going to. Some of them, we have some part-time positions. You may have an office that has 1.5 people. You may end up move a full-time position there, take that half-time position and move it someplace else to augment those. So the individuals get spread across the field offices where the heaviest workload would and heaviest impact would be.
How many DMV offices do we have?
64.
So we have 64 DMV offices, and we're going to take 7 FTE. Not FTE. We're going to take 3.5 FTE and spread those over the 64 to make up for the additional time of looking at a document and making a note in it and verifying it on the computer.
And resolving any problems with the customers, having conversations with the customers about what the new requirements are, all of the things that factor into a change in the system, yes.
Share with us the connection of the systems between what's required to connect to the federal government. I don't understand this. I wasn't in the policy committee. Computer, okay, the primary cost of DMV are for computer programming to connect to the Solve system to verify Social Security numbers. Tell me what that entails.
Mr. Chair, what that would entail would be for us to do the necessary programming on our side in order to actually connect up to the online system that the American Motor Vehicle Association has a proprietary computer network that we're currently all connected to, and that's how we transfer information on commercial driver licenses and on problem drivers. They have created a connection with the Social Security Administration. In order for us to connect up to their connection, it requires reconfiguration of our computer systems. We need to get our computer security involved to make sure that we've got computer security with the connection. Then we have to reconfigure our work screens so that this additional inquiry pops up. So there's just a number of different kinds of computer changes that are needed in order to put it in place to have the inquiries go back and forth. And I'd actually have to bring a computer person in to actually walk through all of the steps that are required in developing a interconnectivity.
Is that a one-time cost?
Yes, it is a one-time cost for the connection, and then we're looking at 3 cents per inquiry.
When I look at the fiscal analysis for the proposed legislation, where do I see that one-time cost?
Mr. Chair, if you were to take, we're probably not. I don't have the. I have my more.
It was a federal fund.
Is there a copy of this?
Mr. Chair, on the front page, you will see federal funds. Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. In that $245,900, most of those are one-time costs. The Federal Motor Carrier Administration will be making available to us grant funding to create the connection. I think $9,000 of it is for ongoing costs. In other words, they will be willing to pay for at least one biennium, the 3 cents per inquiry for commercial drivers only. they're making this money available to states and have made this money available to states. It's one of the reasons why so many states are connected with the Social Security verification system, is because Federal Motor Carrier has been very interested in having states have the commercial driver license Social Security number checked, because that is a requirement that you provide, and they want to make sure that that's accurate. So
federal government would make the initial investment for us.
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you looping us back to the budget discussion, since we are a budget committee. But because part of our job is also to decide whether what we're spending money on is worthy of spending money, it's not always easy to separate the two. I want to go back to the first hypothetical that Chair Smith mm-hmm. gave you, only take it a little bit further. A person walks into the DMV office, gives their old driver's license and documentation. Your folks check it out. It all looks good. And so you reissue the new driver's license. Does that information that person was verified as legal get passed on to the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, I would have to take a look at whether or not the legal status notation in our record would be part of public record versus protected information. Because we would not routinely pass that on, but under the driver records and the driver record privacy act, there are aspects of the driver record which are available to law enforcement, to public entities, as well as the private sector. So I don't have the answer to that.
Would you come back up to the table?
Oh, sure. Please.
Let's stick with just the one hypothetical that I just gave. Does your office, or to your knowledge, any other federal agency look for records of people that have been verified as legal?
Representative Avakian, Mr. Chair, in Oregon, I'm not aware of anything like what you're discussing. In California, where I used to work, there were different rules.
That's all right. Let's not complicate it too much.
Yeah. But in Oregon, I'm not aware of it.
Then let me give you the second, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please, of course.
The second hypothetical. The potential bad guy comes in and drives in and walks up and shows you the prior driver's license and then some other type of identification which your DMV worker rejects, because they can't authenticate it, they can't match it with federal record or something. At that moment that your worker rejects that person and does not reissue the license, what do they do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, if their driver license has expired and we can't renew it, they would be smart to have someone come drive them home.
Okay, but of course my question is, and I am not being, that was very clever. but every once in a while I can stay one step ahead. That would be very good advice, and I am by no means being critical of your agency, which I think does an outstanding job, especially given the additional pressures it has on it. But what is the duty of your employee with regard to that individual whom you have just rejected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, may I ask some clarification what you mean in terms of duty? And are you talking in terms of due process, in the sense of what does that person have a right to?
That's the word duty. Just tell me what they are supposed to do. Do they make a notation? Do they make a phone call? Do they enter something in the computer that this person came in, here's their name, they were rejected? Or do they simply let the person go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, we have not worked out exactly what we would put in the record if an individual, whether or not, if we could not renew an individual based on the fact that they were not legally present. We would undoubtedly have to note in the record that they're not legally present and why we would deny the renewal of a license. If your question is whether or not we would stop them from driving, We don't really have the capacity of doing that. That's a law enforcement issue.
My question was only, I'm taking a little liberty here. Is that
please,
okay?
Of course.
My question was only, what do they do? Now, you could have said, I send them out to the parking lot to stand back of the car. I knew you weren't going to say that. And so at this point, there's not a mechanism for how that would be recorded.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, no, we haven't worked out the details of how we would implement that the bill should it pass.
I understand. And Mr. Ho, what's the response from the federal government, or what are your intentions in how you would get that information, that a person came in, tried to renew a license, and couldn't because they couldn't document that they were legal?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, the point I would make is that the DMV people are not making a determination as to whether a person is legally here or not. What they're making a determination on is whether or not that person presented sufficient documentation and that whether they were legally here or not. It's a fine point, but it's an important distinction because we are not asking DMV representatives to be immigration officers and, say, make arrests or report people. Simply speaking, would happen is they would simply, I would believe, would make a notation that there was insufficient documentation presented to renew or issue a new license. And at that point, that would be it. I don't expect at this point that any information would necessarily be passed to us. I am unaware of, in terms of the Social Security checks, whether that Social Security would pass information to us as well, given that it could very simply be a number error.
Well, let me just try and clarify that then, because you, of course, have been a special agent for Federal Immigration and Homeland Security for 18 years and the manager of immigration laws in the state of Oregon. And what I just heard, and I want to give you a chance to clarify if I'm wrong, is we would pass a bill that would require the proof of residency or citizenship, whatever you want to call it, for to get your driver's license. Yet our DMV at this point doesn't have a manner in which to record that. Later, I would imagine they would if this law were to pass, but would not necessarily pass that information to the federal government. You don't have a mechanism for getting the information. The state of Oregon is not in charge of enforcing immigration laws. You are. And so give us your, for lack of a better word, your expert law enforcement opinion on how in the world we catch the bad guys with that kind of a system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, I think the point is not so much catching people as it is preventing people from being drawn into Oregon in the first place. I think it's about ensuring that the driver's license or identification card has some validity, has some value within the state. It's not necessarily about catching the bad people because, in fact, given the staffing I have in the state, if, hypothetically speaking, I were to suddenly get all the information from DMV, I wouldn't have the staff to pursue all those cases. It simply isn't there.
Well, I guess what I'm having difficulty with is if there's some guy like we've been talking about that's trafficking in drugs or he's going to get on a plane and fly it into a building, if we're going to set up an entire system where they have to prove they're legal and he comes in and we know they can't verify that they're in the country legally, that's the point at which I want somebody to say, we got to track this guy. We got to investigate, or we got to catch him. We got to do something. But the fact they can drive into a DMV, prove, or at least implicitly, that they're not here legally, then go right back out, get in their car, and go back to their life and do whatever they were doing.
So how do we close the link?
Leaves me wondering, where's the national security in that?
How do we close the link?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vakian, in terms of the future, I think the way to close the loop or deal with the Homeland Security issue is through a system called biometrics. The U.S. government currently uses something called U.S. Visit, which is at our land borders, where foreign nationals, when they come in, they present a passport and they also give two fingerprints, their index fingers, and their identity is verified. Now, of course, there's always issues regarding privacy, sharing of data, and the reality is in the real world, we give up a little bit of privacy in order to get some convenience or some benefit. And I think in the real world, in the future, one possibility is that because fingerprints are collected by DMVs already, that those sorts of things, biometrics, could also be used to close the loop and track. But it has to be done in a way that protects civil rights. It has to be done in a way that protects individual privacy. I'm not suggesting that it be done willy-nilly.
Let me add one more thing to that, and I certainly, you don't have to comment because I know you don't chair the Finance Committee in Congress. But if Congress is going to tell us that we need to do that and we need to be doing it through our DMV offices, they darn well better be ready to pay for it.
Do you mind if I take this back to budget?
I don't know. I think we're doing okay.
I'm going back down to a micro issue, but I think it's one that average Oregonians would want to ask. When I walk into the DMV, I know I walk in there with my driver's license and my utility bill to prove where I live and who I am. They look at it, they hand it back. I'm trying to figure out why it requires 45 seconds to take that document, to take my birth certificate and my driver's license and now my utility bill and now my birth certificate and verify who I am.
Mr. Chair, because since 2004, we have strengthened our process of examining original documents for authenticity. And so we're now reviewing birth certificates. We're looking at them under black lights for any kind of security features, if there's any questions about them. We're taking much more time because we know that these documents, because we're relying on a paper document system, we're taking more time with documents. To take a look at immigration papers will require, because they're complex, they require...
January of 04, did we start that?
January of 04, we rolled out a more rigorous set of requirements for what we would accept in the way of documents, and we also coupled that with field training to our field offices for fraudulent document identification. We equipped them all with black lights with additional handheld magnifying glasses to look for security features in both the drive.
So this is for new licenses, not renewals.
For any documents that are presented to us, both driver and vehicle transactions. So certainly on original. And now with any original application, it requires two sets of eyes, one to take a look at it originally and verify that the document's there, and then it is given to the supervisor or lead worker for...
Help me, did I get special treatment in November of 04 when I went in for mine, and they just looked at... My utility bill, because I knew I had to bring it in, and my driver's license, and they just said,
You were on a renewal.
Correct.
And now we would be going back and looking at your birth certificate again, because we already looked at your birth certificate when you were 16, I assume, and got your driver's license. But now with the legal presence requirement, we will be looking at everyone's birth certificate again, or their passport, and that requires we would be kind of like going back to what you would call original issuance again, and we would want another pair of eyes to make sure that. So the process will be longer to go back and look at. Right now, we're actually looking at two documents.
Let me be clear, because I'm confused. Okay. For both new and for renewal.
Everyone will be treated the same, because everyone...
I'm confused, because I thought you just told me we started on 01 of 04.
Mr. Chair, what we started in January of 04 was a more rigorous process for examination of documents itself. So you're asking, why does it take longer to look at documents?
Why in November when I went in, it was, and handed back. I didn't... There wasn't any scanning of my utility bill. There wasn't any, hey, come take a look and see if this is really an electrical bill.
Mr. Chair,
am I missing here?
Okay, Mr. Chair, what you were doing was being renewed. We already had your picture. When you stood there at the counter, the clerk pulled up your picture on their screen and saw it was you. Took a look at your driver license, and all we were doing was, verifying address there, because we wouldn't even had to verify address if you weren't making an address change, because if it's a renewal and there's no address change and you've got your renewal your renewal reminder with you,
the higher level of scrutiny isn't on renewals.
but it will be under this bill. That's the point.
Thank you. That's what I'm saying.
Under this bill, every renewal will now become an original issuance because we're going to go back. I'm sorry if I was not clear about that.
I can be
every
taught.
Renewal, every duplicate will go back to the same level of scrutiny as an original issuance because we now have to make sure you're legally present.
The light bulb has gone on. Thank you. It just didn't click with me. All right. Any other comments for either?
Yeah.
Representative Avakian.
I want to just reiterate one more time that even though I asked some pointed questions, I think you've done a tremendous job, Madam Director, with your agency and would want to continue doing what you're doing. Implicit in my comments were not that I think you should be acting differently. And with respect to you, Mr. Ho, I really do appreciate you being here. It's not often that we get somebody from the federal government that will come down here and talk to us about the issues that you're facing from your side as well. Also, not implicit in my comments are that I think these efforts are wrong. I think that there's questions that need to be asked, like I did. But I have a great concern that we are not prepared in this country yet to protect ourselves like we need to protect ourselves, or that we have mechanisms instilled that will allow us to catch the bad guys when we need to catch them. And the only question is how and whose responsibility it is. On the same token, Mr. Ludwig, I'm very glad you were here to give us your perspective on this, which I think is equally important. So the question is just, are we analyzing the entire issue correctly, both from whether it's a state issue, a federal issue, how it needs to be a combined issue, and how do we protect the civil rights of individuals in the country? And I think we're just at the birthplace of that analysis, which is why so many questions today out of a budget committee that shouldn't be needing to get into the policy side of this. And I would hope that we continue discussing those kinds of questions, because what's obvious to me is that we are not prepared at a state or federal level to do something now with this kind of a plan that will actually catch the bad guys. I don't need you to comment on it. It doesn't seem like we're quite there yet.
Representative Abaki and I get along pretty well. I have a counterpoint. And I'd like to ask this question, and if you're not the individual to answer it, I'll appreciate that. Can you share with me why this request is coming from a legislator and not from the executive branch?
Mr. Chair, it has been essentially, and perhaps my interpretation, that as DMV, our responsibility is to make sure that we have safe drivers. The policy decision about eligibility for the driving privilege beyond whether or not you're a safe driver, I have always felt belongs with the legislature. And the legislature has made that policy decision before in terms of whether or not you're in school, whether or not you're paying child support. And so the decision about whether or not you should have a driver license or ID card because you're present legally or not legally in the U.S., I believe is a policy decision for the legislature, and that is the reason why, I think appropriately so, it has been brought forward by the legislature.
Very fair answer. Thank you very much. Yeah. Very, very fair answer. Thank you. Okay. Andrea Meyer. Welcome. Is that all right?
Yes.
Let's see here. I am terrible with reading handwriting. Is it Asiya? Erica. Where do you see the R in that?
Over there.
Oh, there. Okay, the R is tied to the Y.
Yeah.
All right, Erica, come on up.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, and it's my first time before you. I've provided you testimony.
That's okay.
Well, I've testified in front of him already. I provided you testimony, which I'm going to summarize, and then I want to address some of the things. The ACLU of Oregon opposes House Bill 2608 because it makes us less safe and less free, and it will have a profound effect not only on the immigrant community, but those who are homeless, suffer from mental illness, health conditions, or are in transition. House Bill 2608 fundamentally changes the purpose of the driver's license, which is to ensure that only qualified drivers get behind the wheel, into an internal passport, and you've just heard that discussion. And I think Mr. Ho talked about the value of our driver's license in Oregon and that they're suggesting it doesn't really have a value and this would create a value. I would suggest the value of our driver's license is to ensure that drivers are licensed in terms of and qualified to get behind the wheel. Oregon rightly requires applicants for a driver's license to take a written test on our traffic laws and a practical test on the basic operation of a motor vehicle. These requirements protect our safety. By depriving large numbers of non-citizens of the ability to legally operate a motor vehicle will only increase the number of unlicensed and uninsured drivers on the roads and thereby make our roads less safe.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Why shouldn't somebody living in the state of Oregon, physically living in the state of Oregon, be required to have a driver's license, legally have a driver's license?
Chair Smith, I think I'm either not, as you're asking, you're saying why doesn't every person who is in this state, who is residing in the state, have a driver's license? And I know that's not what you're intending, but I can't answer. Tell me.
Yeah, I'm sorry, just keep going.
And maybe when I finish up and I'll touch on some things that were testified on earlier, it will clarify your questions. This proposal attempts to put the state DMV employees in the business of enforcing extremely complex immigration laws for which they have no authority, little or no training, and limited resources. Instead of making our community safer, such a policy decision will create a climate of fear among immigrant communities, making them less likely to contact local government officials, including the police, when they have information about crimes and terroristic threats. It will also create a whole new sector of uninsured motorists. And not only did your fiscal reflect a loss of revenues, has been noted, there's also going to be a cost to all of us who are driving when we have more and more uninsured drivers. This is an excellent example also of unintended but profound consequences. Although the proponents state that they are targeting only those who are not in this country legally, this law will burden many who are legally in this country. Persons who suffer from mental health issues, those who are homeless or otherwise in transition, simply do not have access or possession to documents necessary to prove their citizenship. Indeed, when I testified on this bill before the committee previously, I think it was Representative Hunt who asked everyone who came up to testify if they had proof of citizenship on them, and I certainly didn't at the time and don't today. But identification cards are crucial for these folks in those communities, for them to get access to housing, employment, Social Security benefits, disability benefits, food stamps, and even access to our federal court buildings. If we deny the susceptible population access to identification because they do not have these primary documents, they don't have a passport, they don't have their Social Security, they don't have them, it will have a profound ripple effect in our communities. And so,
in what way?
Because these folks will be further unable to access resources back within the community, housing, employment. You need the cards and the IDs to even get some of these.
I guess what I'm curious about, if I may, Mr. Chair. So I'm curious about is if we're trying to find out who's legally in the country and who is not legally in the country, why should the people who are here illegally be getting access to those things?
Chair Smith, Representative Vakian, we're not taught what. The proof of, unfortunately for housing and employment and other things we've had, we're talking about the homeless and other populations who need these because you need some form of identification to get a house or an apartment building. This moves us to making it a national immigration card. Our driver's license should not be a determination that you are a citizen or here lawfully. And for these folks in these communities and folks who from the Oregon Law Center who work with these folks, it isn't an issue of are you here legally or not. It's whether you have a form of identification to start accessing housing and employment and other services.
I want to go back to my question.
Go ahead.
I'm confused. Why shouldn't somebody living in the state of Oregon, someone who wants to obtain an Oregon driver's license, be required to be legally in the state of Oregon? What am I missing on that?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, the ACLU's position and others is that's not what we should be having as a criteria to determine whether you can drive the roads. Driver's licenses should be ability to get into a car and drive the roads. They should not be our national ID system. They should not be your passport to establish whether you are lawfully here or not. They are a means that we license to ensure.
We give our, so if somebody who was born and raised in the state of Washington wants an Oregon driver's license, should they just be able to come into Oregon and obtain an Oregon driver's license?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, if they establish the criteria that this legislature has set in the past, and the policy has been that as part of driving, we are not becoming the immigration office in determining your citizenship or resident beyond your residency of being residing in Oregon, so that you can drive the roads.
Can I follow up on that? I want you to talk a little bit about the autonomy of states and federalism, if you will, because it sounds to me like the conclusion that we have to come to based on what you're telling us is that when we know that there is somebody who is probably in violation of federal immigration laws and in the state illegally, that we should still grant them the privileges of the state, which include a driver's license, or housing, or other public assistance like you've described.
Chair Smith, Representative Vakian, when I am speaking of the other public assistance that we are speaking of, I was focusing my comments in that situation to the unintended consequences of your requiring proof of citizenship for people who are indeed even lawfully here. So I am simply pointing out that population. I want to get to the Real ID Act because I sort of think
You to answer this question first, which is if we know that it's probable that somebody is in violation of federal immigration laws, why is it that the state should still be allowing them the privileges of a driver's license?
Chair Smith, Representative Vakian, the state of Oregon has made a policy decision a long time ago that they are not the immigration enforcement agency. They are not making that determination. That is not part of the assessment of whether someone can and should drive the roads.
Yes, but obviously we're revisiting that, this assembly. Well,
we don't believe that that's the appropriate determination and use of our resources and a policy decision that we should move away from. I want to talk about the Real ID Act for a minute because
I've got to interrupt here because we've got a call of the House.
And when we add the because to that, why do you believe that that's the case, is what I'm looking for.
I'm going to stand in recess. Thank you. Sorry on that. We're just kind of running ragged and jumped out front of you. We're going to reopen up our public hearing on 2608. Sheriff, that's really quick. I'm going to try and wrap up our public hearing on this bill in the next 7 minutes.
Absolutely. Well, I want to give Andrea Meyer, ACLU of Oregon, for the record. I don't know if you want me to skip to the big elephant in the room, the Real ID Act, a moment, or if Representative Avakian, who is now back in the room, wants the answer to his questions, which I can give him, which may not answer his questions, but I'll give you a response, if you'd so like the because.
Sure, with the preface that the because, to me, is the big elephant in the room, not the Real ID Act.
Well,
but go ahead.
But you have been asking the issue of the privilege of driving, and I guess I want to challenge that premise. I don't believe driving is a privilege. What it is anyone can buy a car and get on the roads right now. You do not need to obtain anything from the government to get that. As such, you are not seeking a privilege from the government to obtain the benefit of driving. What the government does is they've made a policy decision that, by golly, we want you to be safe. We want you licensed. We want you to have taken a test. We want you to know the rules of the road, and we want you to get insurance. And so as a safety to all of us in the community, we have established where you pay to get a license. The other point I would make in terms about folks whose status of legality should not be an issue, I would just also point out that these folks who are obtaining these licenses and then getting driver's insurance are also probably paying taxes and working in our communities. And so they are providing financial resources to the government, and in turn they are paying for this driver's license. I want to talk just quickly again to focus back on one of the unintended consequences. Let's say you make the policy decision that you have to be legally here, and you have to prove that. So you make that policy decision.
Legally here in the state of Oregon.
And you're in the state of Oregon. I want to raise what I feel is not fully been captured by previous testimony comments, is the hurdles this is going to provide to many people who are here illegally. Seniors who grew up in Kansas, born in 1935. Do they have proof of their citizenship on them today? I do not know. Many people probably do not. It is going to be extremely difficult hurdle that you're imposing on people who are here lawfully. And I talked to someone during the break who talked about a relative who has mental health issues and needed the ID simply to access housing and other things. And that hurdle, if you can't have the ID because you do not have those papers with you, and we are really talking about a vulnerable population, and I just want us to keep that in mind as we look at the policy decisions. In concluding, you heard some mention of the Real ID Act that's coming down in 2008. There are no regs written on that yet. We do not know what that means. There's one thing we know. We know that the legislative folks, the drivers folks, the governors, all those associations oppose this. It is probably one of the largest unfunded mandates you have in coming down. You are going to be required to comply with it, whether the ACLU or anyone else likes it, but we don't know what the regs are. You should not proceed with this, setting up a new system through DMV today, when next session we need to be, and right now what DMV needs to be looking at as the rules get written by Department of Homeland Security, and they're not done yet, what the costs and the options are to comply with the Real ID Act. What all those requirements are, we do not know yet. But that's where a huge cost is going to be, whether I like it as a policy decision or not. And it's premature to move financially on this. I had more things to say, but I'll leave it at that so that other folks have time. Thank you.
I flip my question.
Sure.
So do you think it's okay for someone who's illegally residing in the state of Oregon to have a driver's license?
Chair Smith, I would hope that someone who is not here legally does have a driver's license for my safety and yours when I'm out on the road, and I hope with that license they've also procured insurance so that if they get into an accident and they crash into me and it's their fault, they're paying for it, not me. Yes, and that they know the rules of the road. Absolutely. I think it's okay.
Wow.
Okay. Thank you.
Real quick, on the Real ID point, just to consider, we're one of, and I'm sure the testimony came earlier, we're one of only 9 or 11 states that doesn't really do what we're doing now. And you're right, the final regs and the final state requirements for the Real ID Act haven't been fully written yet. But the fact of the matter is, what's understood, the other 41 states are there. It's the 9 states, including Oregon, that we don't know where it's going. We know the direction it's going, and part of the problem here, if we wait 2 years, we're so far away from it now, it's going to be that much harder for us and those other 9 states to recover. Whereas if we do it now, we know the general direction. We don't know the exact, but we know the general direction. We're saving ourselves a lot of time and resources 2 years from now.
Chair Smith, Representative Brin, I think it was last session I learned more from DMV about their computer system and how archaic it is and how difficult it is to create a new entry box in their system. I think to comply with the Real ID Act, you are going to be looking at a lot of information from DMV about cost of structural implementation. And what you're asking is that they expend costs, and I think their costs don't cover a lot of things. I think one of the points they forgot to mention is they may have covered it, but reissuing all the time factors related to it, you're going to have everyone showing up to get their driver's license without proof. Most people, without the right kind of proof of citizenship, they're going to have to go back and come again. So you're having at least 2 visits, which is going to increase the cost. But for them to go down the road to start creating a computerized and process system and a structural system, which they'll have to do to comply with this one aspect, may be the wrong road, the wrong machinery, the wrong system, when they're going to have to maybe do a potential full overhaul. That may include the Social Security stuff, but it may be wrapped into a far bigger system, and they don't know what it is right now. It may be a biometric, too. And we're pulling out one aspect of it, one thread, when we shouldn't, because we're going to have to build a far larger.
I move on here. Erica, welcome.
Erica.
Thank you. I'm chair members of the committee. My name is Erica Steinbauer, and I work as an organizer for PECUN, which is Oregon's farm worker union. I've worked for the last 2.5 years directly with immigrants and farm workers, primarily here in Marion County. And I also wanted to draw your attention to written testimony submitted by Oregon Law Center. Nargis was unable to be here today, but we also share her position, and we've worked together with national advocacy groups and also with the Latino DMV task force on this issue. And we are also here in opposition to House Bill 2608. As Andrea already mentioned, we also share their position that passing this bill, we understand that the Real ID Act was passed in May, but we believe that passing this bill this session is premature because we do have until 2008 to implement the Real ID Act, and we are still waiting regulations. We also believe that the Real...
A letter for the conference.
Can we finish
this? Yeah, we're going to do this just
Let's
for...
Let's finish
yeah.
this.
Okay. You can read the rest of her testimony. The other point I wanted to just touch on is that you're right about there being an elephant in the room, and that is that our immigration laws are broken, and what Congress did instead of passing a comprehensive immigration reform bill in May was they passed the Real ID Act, which is why we're in this position having to deal with this. But like it or not, we have many undocumented, hardworking immigrants who are the backbone of our economy here, who are taxpaying, who don't want to be undocumented, who would really love to adjust their paperwork, but they're on waiting lists that go for like 10 or 12 years. So I think we should really be mindful of that extremely vulnerable population that we're putting further into the shadows if we would pass this session.
Just one question, then we have to head upstairs. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your position is representative of the average Oregonian?
I think that if average Oregonians believe in values represented by the immigrant community of hard work and family, many families want to be reunited. So once in conversations with people, once I break down how our immigration laws are structured and why they need to be changed, they're common values that people really share. So I think that if we do that education, yes. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2608. And we are going to stand in recess. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1040. We're just going to go right down the list here, and why don't I call up Patrick first. Welcome. You can just introduce yourself for the record when you're ready.
Thank you. I was going to say good morning, but I guess it's good afternoon.
We've been here all day, haven't we?
Thank you, Chairman Smith, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to comment this morning. I'm Patrick Pine. I'm Corporate Benefits Manager of ESCO Corporation. I'm testifying in my role as President of the Oregon Healthcare Purchasers Coalition. I'm urging your support of Senate Bill 1040B this morning on behalf of the employer purchasers of group healthcare. The Purchasers Coalition is composed of member companies and organizations who either provide self-insured group medical benefits or purchase insured group medical benefits. An example, not an exhaustive list, of some of the members of the coalition in addition to ESCO Corporation, my employer, include Geldwin, ADEC, and Blount Industries, to name a few. We also represent the interests of numerous employers who attain or acquire medical benefits through trusts, including the TOC Management Trust, which serves many wood products and manufacturing businesses located in virtually every county in Oregon, as well as the United Metal Trades Association Trust, which serves a wide variety of metals industry businesses throughout the state. I did attach in the handout that I think has been distributed to you a summary from TOC Management Services to illustrate its representation of many employers throughout the state and its expression of support of Senate Bill 1040, since their representative was unable to join me today. The coalition does need more useful information regarding various aspects of the costs and benefits of health care services for employers who purchase health benefits, their employees, and their dependents. One area where adequate transparency is lacking involves the actual cost and quality of hospital services. Hospital services are the largest single component of total health care service costs, typically estimated as about one-third or more of total costs for health services. Hospital-related costs have been reported to be the fastest rising component of health care costs over the past 2 years in many reputable studies. We are also pursuing many initiatives to better assess the costs and benefits of all health services, and I think that is important. I wanted to note that for you today because I think it's important to point out that we are not singling out hospitals in our efforts to be more informed purchasers. The coalition has been seeking more transparency about hospital-related costs and quality for about 3 years now. We initially attempted to use an approach that would not involve governmental intervention. We proposed that approach, an approach which would have used the services of an independent actuarial firm, and we did work with a group of individuals, including several from various hospitals, to develop a means of gathering and providing information that met several tests that I want to summarize. The tests we attempted to apply, and I'll comment further about these tests later on. First, we wanted to develop information about what are known as allowed charges, which are those charges that are actually paid for services by those who have group insurance as opposed to the use of what are known as billed charges. And I can comment later about that, but that was one fundamental test that we wanted to meet. Second test we wanted to meet was to keep the cost of information assembly low by selecting a limited set of common hospital services and also to focus on those services with a significant, relatively high cost relative to other services. And that's mainly because if you try to capture all the information, that could be very costly. Finally, we wanted to protect the legitimate interests of hospitals and address their concerns by employing methods of defining those services, averaging these allowed costs, and aggregating them in published data. Due to the complexity and a variety of legitimate issues that we are unable to resolve as well as we had hoped, we were unable to develop an agreed-upon approach, not involving the approach that we now have. However, when Senate Bill 1040 was introduced, we consistently supported the general concept of greater transparency of hospital cost information, and we volunteered to participate in collaborative efforts to develop amendments to effectively address virtually all of the concerns that we have heard. We believe the current version of Senate Bill 1040 meets all of these tests very well, and that is why we support Senate Bill 1040B. Now, as you may know, companies like ESCO Corporation are typically quite reluctant to embrace the notion of governmental involvement. This area is one exception, I think, and this is a case where I think involving the state and existing processes and resources of the state does help all of us meet our mutual goals. I want to close my prepared testimony by commending the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems for its recent development of a public website. It is understandable that there have been concerns about the manner in which this information will be gathered and published, as well as very legitimate concerns about the potential costs of this effort. The amendments that led to Senate Bill 1040B were carefully crafted in a cooperative manner to address all of these concerns. On behalf of employers throughout the state, I urge you to pass Senate Bill 1040B. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pine. Very helpful testimony. I don't have any questions. And so Ms. Long and Mr. Becker, why don't you two come up together?
He's smart. He brings them up together and gets them going. Welcome.
I did.
It's a good, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a good thing I have multiple personalities.
There you go. You can just introduce yourself for the record. Yeah.
For the record, my name is Mike Becker. I'm Director of Public Policy for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 1040, the Hospital Cost Transparency Bill. Consumer-directed health care and health savings accounts are driving the demand for additional information about health care cost and quality. Regis Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon has worked with employer groups, including the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers, for over 2 years to bring about more transparency of hospital allowed charge information. Recently, on June 14th of this year, the Wall Street Journal published an article dealing with the new consumer-driven health plans. And in that article, they quoted a study from McKinsey & Company. And that study stated that consumer-driven health plans are indeed generating greater engagement from healthcare consumers, but many are frustrated by a lack of information on which to base the decisions they need to make. A Towers Perrin study is quoted in this article as finding that 85% of participants in consumer-directed healthcare said they needed more information and tools to make good decisions about healthcare. Providing this type of information to consumers and employers is exactly the thing that Senate Bill 1040 is designed to do. We believe Senate Bill 1040 is reasonable and a workable proposal. Senate Bill 1040 protects the privacy interests of individuals and the trade secret and privacy interests of hospitals and health plans by preventing disclosure of negotiated contract rates or personally identifiable health care information. Health insurers, not hospitals, will report the allowed charge information that they have in their data systems to the insurance division. The reporting requirements of Senate Bill 1040 are not burdensome, and they are easily complied with by health insurers. The hospital cost transparency resulting from the passage of Senate Bill 1040 will benefit consumers and employer health care purchasers. For this reason, and the reasons in the record previously, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon supports this bill and urges the committee to pass it. It is a reasonable and workable proposal for additional transparency of hospital aggregate allowed charges. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Alrighty, Lori?
Lori had another meeting. I have an unsigned copy of the letter that she was going to introduce to testimony, but I don't know if a signed copy of that letter has been given to the committee. I can give you what I have.
Either way is fine by me.
Yeah, I understand. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, signed copies over there? Okay, perfect.
Yes.
Mike, would you mind staying around a little bit through this in case we need to call you back up?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, we
do have a few. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Why don't we call Scott, why don't you come on up? We appreciate you coming even though you're a little under the weather today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I'm too irascible to worry about a cold, but I appreciate your concern. The Medical Association worked with the proponents of this legislation on language to assure that individualized information for physicians and in addition to that, that the underlying data would not be under the public records disclosure portions. This legislation, I think, is a beginning of a process to enable patients, businesses, and others to have a better understanding of the differences between charges, what people are actually paid, what kind of impact that may have in their negotiations overall on premium rates when they talk to insurers about health care coverage. I think in the longer run, this begins to lay a base for further projects that I think will be important to the state and, again, to those who have health insurance coverage in regard to pay-for-performance issues, quality issues, outcome issues, as this data becomes more sophisticated and more mature. I don't believe, and the association doesn't believe, that this would do any harm to those who are included in this, which does, in fact, include fundamentally physician data as well. And we would encourage the committee to endorse the bill and move it to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Bruce, I don't see Bruce in here.
No.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this? I need a point of clarification on the process, and so let me throw the question out, and whoever feels most compelled to answer the question, come on up. So my understanding is what we're looking at doing is polling for information, taking that information, aggregating it, and then providing a study that will say, on average or on median, here is what certain health care costs are. Is that – could someone come up and just walk through this? I just want to make sure I'm very clear on this. Welcome back. If you just introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman. Patrick Pine. I think, Mr. Chairman, my response would be, without getting too detailed, that's exactly the process. There is an advisory mechanism so that insurers will work with the insurance office on the exact details of how this will be worked out. There were several features to control and protect the legitimate concerns, particularly expressed by hospitals, but some insurance plans about negotiated rates. But I thought about how to respond to this, and let me give you an example that I think kind of explains why this allowed versus bill charge is a significant factor. There's a company that sells consumer-directed health plans. It's a national company, and then they recently published a study done in Minneapolis, St. Paul, but I think it's illustrative for any community. In Minneapolis-St. Paul, they studied 12 major hospitals, general-purpose hospitals in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and they selected a common procedure, in this case, MRI procedures, that all of them were delivering, and where there shouldn't be that much variation in cost, quite frankly. When they looked at bill charges, they reported that there was a less than a 5% variation in the bill charges that were published by the 12 hospitals in that metropolitan area. However, when they analyzed allowed charges, they found an over 200% difference in the allowed charges that were paid for MRI services in Minneapolis-St. Paul last year. And those differences from the bill charges were, in some cases, quite dramatic. That is why the purchaser community says that we really need to have a better look at the allowed charges so we really know kind of what we are really paying for through the plans that we provide to our employees. The differences between billed and allowed are quite significant in many cases.
Is there a mechanism in place to ensure you're not comparing a orange with a, say, a tangerine? And I apologize, I don't know the technical.
Both in the original coalition study and then in the proposed mechanisms provided in Senate Bill 1040, there will be what are known as DRGs, or diagnostic-related groups. There'll be a select sample of those, because one of the issues was, how do you get more apples to apples? And there will be a select number of those chosen for analysis and reporting, because it, frankly, would be impossible to cover the waterfront. There's so many different services and possible accommodations. So that was the reason, in all the discussions that I'm familiar with, there has been a feeling that we have to focus on certain common types of services defined on a common way to address the concern that has been expressed about that. And this bill has been designed to do that. This is not going to try to price every single service or even remotely close to that. It will be a select sample, but it will be of those things that are most commonly done to a wide variety of population, and or it will be coupled with looking at what I would call procedures or services that are relatively high cost relative to other things, because those are the two areas of greatest concern to purchasers like me.
So if someone was opposed to this bill, why would they be opposed to it?
I can't really speak, but let me see, tell you, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would respond that if I understand the argument, I think the concern is that this is a very complex area. It's very difficult to understand, even for people who spend a lot of time with it. And I believe the legitimate concern is, will the lay public, if you will, draw the correct inferences when they read this information, or will they draw conclusions that are actually invalid or erroneous and maybe draw the incorrect conclusions? I guess I would characterize the concern as that is that what's going to happen.
And then how would you respond to that?
My response to that is we cannot support this concept that even people like President Bush are supporting of consumer-directed health care if we don't provide useful consumer information, both to individuals and to our group purchasers, if we don't find some ways to make relevant information on which I can make some sort of an informed purchasing decision. So if we don't make the effort, the question is, how do you successfully support health savings accounts and all of those ideas? I think there's a necessary, we have to make some effort to provide useful information to purchasers, or that concept will not work.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 1040? Seeing no other testimony before the committee, then we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1040, and we are going to, now if I, help me here, if I adjourn, then we have to post again.
That is correct.
If I recess, then we can come back late this afternoon.
Yes, you can. I think you're trying to recess to reopen the work session.
Correct.
Yes, you can recess until a later time.
Okay, so we're going to do is we are going to recess until a later time this afternoon.
Do we have to have time specific?
Emory, thank you very much.